Hi, friends. Hope you had a great week. Glad to be with you today. Because today we're starting a new series. It's called I Am. In this series, we're going to examine one of the most widely known books of the Bible. It's the book of Exodus. Now, before we do that, I'm going to take just a few minutes and ask God to prep our hearts. Can we do that? Please bow your heads with me. Father, over the next several minutes, we need to hear from you. In the coming weeks, we'll read about all kinds of miracles and signs and wonders. We'll read about frustrations and tragedies. But I ask that you do what you've done really for thousands of years. And that is speak through these events. Speak through these words as you did in ancient times, as you've done through church history. Speak and speak loud. Reveal yourself to us. Because it's when we find out who you really are, that's when we are transformed. That's when we are shaped into the people you want us to be. Do that, we ask, in the name of Jesus. Amen. How many of you ladies went to this women's retreat this week? Yeah, a good portion of you here. Tara mentioned earlier about the game that they played. She asked the question, what's something unique about you? And if you get some interesting responses just now, well, the ladies certainly did this, and, it was fun, it was all part of the game, and they all got to share in some cases, very, very strange things about themselves. Without their permission, I'd like to share a few of them with you today. One of our ladies was a train conductor. True, very cool. One owns mother and daughter chinchillas. One lady performed live in costume in Las Vegas. That may or may not be her. One of our women was the 1986 Midwest Women's Barefoot Water Skiing Champion. No kidding. Okay, you know what? I've got to know this. If you are here and you're not embarrassed, don't feel like you have to. Who are you? I got to know this. Are you here?
She's not here.
She's... Oh, does she?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I tried.
I never knew it about
you. Fascinating, though. One of our ladies has trouble telling left from right. How many of you have trouble telling left from right? Yeah, okay. And you know what? She told me I could tell you this. It's my wife. I know that sounds stupid. She's actually quite smart, but here's how you know. You ready? L, left. That's how she has to remember this. It's just something that, well, there you have it. Another is terrified of clowns. Any of you have a clown fear? A clown phobia? Yeah, I'm just giving you nightmares, aren't I? They're looking right at you. And still another of our ladies has seen the movie Dirty Dancing 150 times. She has me beat by 150. Now, while these facts are interesting, and some a little frightening, by the way, they don't tell us much about who these women really are. If you were to read a biography of one of these ladies, hey, even an autobiography, you'd get a lot of information, but you still wouldn't know them as well as a close friend might know them. Because the best way to get to know someone is by firsthand experience. Hearing their words, seeing their actions, and engaging them personally so that they choose to reveal themselves to you. Now, I believe it's no different with God. You can read about him. You can study theology. You could get multiple degrees in theology and yet not know him. You can hear what your friends have to say about him, and in some ways experience God through your friends' experience with God. But you won't really know him until you personally engage him. And that is what is really at the core of this book of Exodus. It's God revealing to his people and to the world. He's revealing himself, showing us who he really is. That's what was going on in those ancient times. And then this book really does a great job of laying a foundation of God's character, God's attributes, how he interacts with the world. It's a book of divine self-disclosure. Now, this book of Exodus picks up right where the book of Genesis leaves off. You may have been with us a little over a year ago where we looked at the story of Joseph. We did a series called God in the Driver's Seat. Any of you remember this? In this series, we looked at this life of Joseph. And by the way, if you've never read the story of Joseph, I really recommend you pick it up. If you're wondering, what in the world do I even read in the Bible? This might be a fascinating story for you. It's in Genesis 37 and following. Wonderful story about a guy who started where he felt was he was on top of the world, but his life just came unraveled. But the whole way, God was with him. God had a plan. And through this, the trials and suffering of Joseph, God strategically made it possible for Joseph to be at the right place at the right time, to where he could really be a savior, so to speak, to not just his family, the family of Israel, but to the whole world as he saved that whole region from drought, from famine. Now, at the close of Genesis, because of Joseph, because of what he did, the Israelites were living in the lap of luxury. Joseph, son of Israel, was second in command to this most powerful empire. So they had anything they wanted. They had the favor of the Pharaoh. Things were looking up for the Israelites. And so even after Joseph's death, we find that they prospered. I want to take you to Exodus chapter 1 and verse 6. We read, "Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. But their fortunes soon changed." Verse 8. "Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt." Verse 9. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." Verse 11, "So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor." Okay, the new Pharaoh's feeling threatened by this ever-increasing Israelite population, so he makes them slaves. Verse 14, "They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. And in all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly." But Pharaoh's oppression never stops the Israelites from thriving. Verse 12. "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. Later, Pharaoh's insecurity drives him to further brutality." Look at verse 15. "The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, 'When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live.'" Verse 17. "The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live." The text continues. "The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, 'Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?' Verse 19, "The midwives answered Pharaoh, 'Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive.'" And apparently Pharaoh bought this. The narrator explains, verse 20, "So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Now, Pharaoh is still very upset. He will not be satisfied until he subdues these people. Verse 22, then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. I want you to imagine the injustice of being an Israelite. It's bad enough to be forced to leave your family business, to make bricks for a king who cares nothing for you and in fact would love to wipe you off the face of the planet. And then on top of all that, to then take the pride of your life, your brand new baby boy, and have him tossed into the Nile. What if you were part of that community? What if you were one of the children of Israel in those days? If I were, even just reading this, I have got to ask a question. A question that's been asked for centuries. A question that in times like this is probably the first question that comes to mind. Where's God? Where is he? Where's the blessing given to Abraham? You know, God met with Abraham and he told him, he said, Abraham, I'm going to make you, I'm going to bless you and I'm going to bless your generations. I'm going to bless your generations into being a great nation. Where's the great nation? This is hundreds of years later. Where's that great nation? Does this sound like a great nation to you? I find it interesting as you look back through chapter 1 and really a lot of chapter 2, scholars have grappled for centuries with the theology of God's absence in these opening chapters. Where's God? When you read the book of Genesis and you just read the Joseph account, you'll find that, yes, things were coming unhinged for Joseph. Things were just falling apart all around him. His life was terrible. But you'd see that the narrator reminds his reader, but the Lord was with him. But the Lord was with him. And the narrator would tell you as a reader what God was doing behind the scenes. And then God allowed this to happen. And then God did this and God did that. You see that? And so you see that even though Joseph was in this dark season, God was with him. The narrator's not saying that. Not in Exodus chapter 1. The only time that God is mentioned, he's mentioned when the midwives trusted him. They feared him, so they didn't want to kill the children. And so it says that God blessed them with more children, right? That's the only thing that God did. You know the old saying, when the going gets tough, have lots of kids. Because kids make everything easier. Now, of course kids are a blessing. And of course the Israelites would have seen children as a blessing. But why didn't God answer their other prayers? Where was he? Where was God when the Egyptian slave masters arrived? Where was God when the midwives were instructed to murder these young babies? Where was God when Pharaoh gave this genocidal decree? Where was he? What does it mean if, as I told you, a primary theme of this book of Genesis is God revealing himself to the world? Okay? In his actions that are reported in Exodus, God is revealing himself to the Israelites and to the world, right? Major theme of the book. What does it mean when the first two chapters of this book opens up with an MIA God? For now, we'll live with that tension. Let that tension speak to you for a moment. We'll move ahead to chapter 2, verse 1. Now, a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant. and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. Imagine trying to hide a little baby. Hush, little baby. Mercy. Verse 3. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister, who we'll meet again many, many years later, by the way, stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Okay, let's review. We have a frightened but crafty mother, a baby in a basket, a daughter as a spy, but God's nowhere to be found. Verse 5. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Verse 7. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Verse 8. Yes, go, she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. It's a great story. Many of you know this story. Some of you learned it as a child with flannel graph. Any of you learned this story with flannel graph? Any of you have no idea what flannel graph is? Yeah, it's okay. That's okay. It didn't shape me as a person, I don't think. But for those of you who heard this long ago, did any of your teachers point out the absence of God? Because most scholars will tell you the narrator's trying to let us in on that. He's not there. He's not mentioned. Well, of course, the big question is, was he truly absent? Because it sure feels like he is. And if you were to have a conversation with one of those Israelite families back many, many centuries ago, I suppose they would concur. Where is God? Maybe you've been there. Maybe you are there. Maybe you're in one of those spaces where you are wondering, okay, God, hello, where are you? And it's hard to pray anymore because you don't even know if he's there. And if he's there, you don't even know if he's listening to you. Because, I mean, come on, if he was really there, wouldn't you see him? Wouldn't you feel him? If God were really there, would the circumstances of your life be like they are? Wouldn't things be different? Maybe. Maybe not. Could God be closer than we think? What if he's been there all along? What if he's working and you just can't see him? Last year, I read an absolutely spectacular book. It's called Organic God by Margaret Feinberg. It's one of the best books I read last year, in fact. I just love this author. In this book, she describes her new life in Alaska. She lived in Juneau, And I'd like to read a segment of this book to you. Feinberg writes, "The very first time I encountered a glacier was here in Juneau. I'd seen a volcano bubbling with lava, coral reefs teeming with organic colored or rainbow-colored fish, as well as Old Faithful and the Grand Tetons. I thought a visit to Mendenhall Glacier would be a nice outing in the been there, done that, check it off the list kind of way. I didn't expect it to render me speechless. As we came down the road toward the glacier, I was awed by its beauty and power. The glacier was enormous and stretched into the mountains as far as the eye could see. The icy surface wasn't easily contained, filling the entire valley like a down comforter. The glacier was anything but soft, warm, or safe. The frozen surface was scarred by deep crevices. Along the rough exterior, rocks as small as pebbles and as large as elephantine boulders stained the snowy surface. The glacier was on the move, and it was changing everything it touched. In its wake, the glacier was transforming the land. The valley took on a new design that was wider and in some areas smoother. Many of the rocks that the glacier touched became nothing more than fine silt. A kind of glacier tell that feels like powder to the touch. Even the vegetation that springs up in the wake of the glacier was different. More tender and rich with a vibrant, youthful green." She continues, "Since that initial encounter, the glacier's become a kind of personal holy place where I go to reflect on the attributes of the organic God." She says, "The glacier makes me think of God because like God, it is big, powerful, and constantly on the move. I've spent afternoons on the silt-filled banks of the lake at the foot of the icy mass. For hours on end, nothing appears to be happening. Ever so slowly, its presence is moving, carving, purifying, and reshaping everything with which it comes into contact. In some ways, this reminds me of my faith. Those moments when I cry out in prayer asking God to act or respond. Too often, it doesn't look or feel like He's doing anything. But like the glacier, He is on the move." I don't know what may be happening in your life, but you may be in one of those spaces where God feels absent. It happens more often than I care to admit. I wrestle with this as a communicator. I feel like this is a motif we return to often in these messages. But the reason is it's a motive or a motif that the Bible returns to often, because it's a motif that our lives return to often. Those seasons when you, "Hello, God." And you may be staring at your life right now and you see no movement. You see nothing. Well, I believe with all my heart that even though you can't see Him, God is up to something. God is up to something. Look at Exodus chapter 2 and verse 23. "The people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. For those of you who are really following carefully, you notice I switched translations on you because I think this one does a great job of showing you a little more literally what's going on here in Hebrew. You've got four verbs piled up. God heard, God remembered, God saw, God knew. The narrator loads up on these verbs, and they're powerful verbs, more powerful than our little English words really can reflect. This idea of God hearing. This little word hearing is a lot more than just God cleaned out his ears and he's finally listening. No, no, no. This means God hears and responds. When it says that God remembered, this isn't just, oh yeah, I remember those people and I think I might have made them a promise. No, he never forgot. This idea of remembering is about focused attention, total concentration on something or someone. God remembered. It says that he saw. He saw everything. He saw every family. God saw every brick. And God saw every boy. And God knew. Well, that's a beautiful word. It's a Hebrew word, yada, to know. I remembered memorizing it as a young Hebrew student. Yada, to know. It's like yada, yada, yada. You know the rest. There you go. You just learned a little Hebrew. Yada. Well, you got to remember it somehow, right, students? This beautiful word, yada, is... I'm always in trouble when I leave my notes, by the way. That's never a good idea. This little word, yada, is a great word that talks about not just an intellectual knowledge of something or someone, but a deep personal connection. I'm talking about intimacy. I'm talking about empathy. God looks down on his people and God knew. Here's what the narrator tells us. We go through chapter 1 with an apparently MIA God. We go through chapter 2, and where is God? Because it's not saying God prompted Moses' mother to make this little basket, and God prompted the sister to be a spy, and God moved on the heart of Pharaoh's daughter, and da-da-da-da-da. Nope, doesn't say that. And it didn't feel like it. But we get to the end, and we realize, my friends, God was there all along. He was there all along. Now, of course, hindsight is 20/20. But if you know what to look for, you can see God's fingerprints all over Exodus 1 and Exodus 2. I mean, this whole text is filled with all kinds of very strange coincidences. The whole text is rich with irony and foreshadowing. There's one scholar, an Old Testament scholar, Terence Fredheim, that points out a lot of these. But I want to just list a bunch of them for you. It's a lot, so stay with me. You ready? You open up Exodus 1, and you find this insecure and evil king, Pharaoh. He plans to murder all the sons. Because he's thinking, by toppling the men, this whole thing will come undone and it'll strip the Israelites of their power. So God decides to use the daughters. Look at the women in Exodus 1 and Exodus 2. It's the women who make it happen. And the lady said, amen. Now that's uncommon in those days. That's uncommon in those days, but you know what? God doesn't care. He's a lot bigger than the traditions of man. Then, when the mother of Moses gave birth to her boy, our translation that I read a little earlier says that she looked at, she saw him and she said he was a fine child. The words, more literally would be translated, she saw him and she saw that he was good. Now, does that ring a bell to any of you little Bible scholars in the room? Where have you heard that before? Genesis 1. And she's using the same language that God used after God created the earth and he saw that it was good, right? You see the parallels. This is written intentionally. This is written intentionally. Pharaoh orders that the baby boys all be tossed into the Nile. So the mother does just that. Now, she puts her own little twist on it. Yes, she puts him in the Nile. What she does is she places him in a basket among the reeds. Now, the reeds, this is important for a number of reasons. First of all, I always got this picture of little baby Moses in the basket floating down the Nile, you know? You know what kind of crocodiles live in the Nile? I mean, that's a frightening river. It's not Moses, you know, floating down the aisle. No, it's his idea of she puts him in the reeds, so he doesn't go anywhere. He doesn't go anywhere. And it's not, the narrator's not just telling us this just to give us superfluous details. Sometime later, as an adult, Moses would lead the Israelites to cross a sea. What's the name of the sea? Most of it's known as the Red Sea. In those days, it was known as Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds. Okay? She places him in a basket. Of course, so he wouldn't drown. That makes perfect sense. What you don't know is that word that the narrator uses there for a basket, it is used only one other time in all the Old Testament. It is the same word used for Noah's ark, which God instructed Noah to make to protect the people. Pharaoh's own daughter, this is brilliant. Pharaoh's own daughter, the princess of Egypt, defies the edict of her father and rescues the child. So that the Nile, this Nile River, which was supposed to be a place of death for Moses and for his people, that Nile River actually becomes a place of life, a place of redemption for the people of God. And then this Egyptian princess actually listens to a Hebrew slave girl. She takes her advice. She says that would be a great idea. And so the little girl goes off to get some vague, arbitrary Hebrew mother to nurse the baby. Ha ha. She goes to get the actual mother, her mother, of the child, Moses. Now, because of this, the way this worked, to nurse a baby like that, that meant that the mother, we'll later find her name's Jochebed, she actually raises Moses in early childhood. Just a few hours before, she wondered if she would see her baby die. But now, she has been given royal authorization to raise her own child. And my friends, guess what? She's going to get paid for it. And who's going to pay the bill but Pharaoh? Got it? Pharaoh's daughter gives him the name Moses, which in Egyptian language means to give birth. It's a pretty common name. Moses and all of its variants were used pretty commonly in the Egyptian Empire. We don't know for sure if she intended to do this, but the name in Hebrew means to draw out. It's the word Moshe. It means to draw out. It refers to the Moses being drawn out of the Nile, right? Makes perfect sense. Oh, that's neat, and that's tricky, and that's pretty obvious. But do you know that there's, again, some divine foreshadowing? Moses leading the people, drawing them out of the Red Sea. I mean, you could just pile all these things up. And I'm just scratching the surface. There are so many little parallels and things like that where if you really look back on Exodus 1 and Exodus 2 and all the little tricky bits that are involved there, God is all over that thing. His fingerprints are all over it. And here's the I just love this. On top of all of this, Moses, the great deliverer of the people of God, the individual who causes Pharaoh so many problems, will now be raised, clothed, fed, and educated in the royal household right under the nose of King Pharaoh. Now, my friends, hear me out. All of that is classic Yahweh. That is classic God. Yahweh's the Israelite name of God. We'll look at that next week. But this is just classic God. This is just like him to do stuff like this. It is just like him to be right in the middle of everything without anybody knowing it. I mean, it's all these little things are so hidden but so obvious. They're so complex, so simple. And when you see it in the end, you get the perspective. I mean, it's poetic, actually, how God unveils his plan almost as if he had a plan. Ha-ha! But that takes us back to where we are, perhaps today. Our lives. Our problems. Our pharaohs. Our Niles. Our Egyptian slave masters. I believe with all my heart that Yahweh, this God of the Israelites, this God of the Bible, he is the Lord of time and history. He's got everything in his hands. And I know you don't feel like it. It may not seem like it. But in spite of appearances, in spite of feelings, you've got to know in your life, God hears, God remembers, God sees, and God knows. What if this were true? Well, if God really is God of time and history, and if he really hears and remembers and sees and knows, then, my friends, I am way too uptight about the future. I am. I am way too worried about next week. If God really is the God and Lord of time and history, then I can trust him even when I can't see him. When the going gets tough, I can trust. Yeah, he hears my cry. He remembers his promises. He sees my pain, and he loves me with the deepest empathy. He's never left me. He's never left me. I really believe God is up to something. God is up to something. Do you trust him? You trust him to let things flesh out the way he wants them to flesh out? Do you trust him to know better? When you see injustice, you're angry, and you should be. But do you trust that this great God of heaven has got everything in his hands, and he's got a plan? He's on the move. And yes, we need to cry out, and yes, we need to act. But we need to act in faith in him and trust in him and never be shaken. Even when we see evil, even when we see suffering, trust him. In that book I read earlier, the chapter continues where Margaret Feinberg relays a story about how she encountered this deeply mysterious God at a water park, of all things. Let me read it. She says, "Recently I found myself enjoying a thrilling afternoon with friends in a water park. We raced down, splashed down, swam in Commotion Ocean, and floated down Castaway Creek. Leif, her husband, decided he wanted to try Acapulco Cliff Dive, a 65-foot-tall high-speed freefall slide. Knowing what the ride would inadvertently do to my swimsuit, I decided to hang out at the bottom of the slide and watch. That's when I saw him. He was only 5 years old. A purplish-blue birthmark stained the right side of his face, his neck, his arm, all the way down to his fingers. I couldn't take my eyes off the unruly discoloration or the boy who was smiling wildly, sparkling with glee. He was ready for another round in the wave pool. I stared at that dark blemish, knowing the social pain that it would cause the boy. And a single question sprang from my heart. Why, God? I solemnly offered up those two words in what sounded more like a pang than a prayer. The question I was asking God was about so much more than the boy. Why, God, do we live in a fallen world? Why, God, do we live with so much suffering? Why, God, do we live with so much imperfection? One sole person's sentence flooded my mind. You don't know the plans I have for him. I breathed deeply, releasing the tension I felt in my soul. I recognized my pride in assuming that I knew what was best for this young boy. My pride in assuming that the blemish had escaped God's notice. My pride in assuming that somehow God couldn't handle it. I asked for God's forgiveness. I asked for his grace. I asked for a special blessing on the child. Like the glacier, God re-landscapes my attitudes and knowledge of him. In unexpected places, God continues the transformation and purification process. Please bow your heads with me. Well, God, you are absolutely enormous, infinite, omnipotent, mighty in every way. In the coming weeks, we will see through this, just this book of Exodus, how mighty you are. But for some of us here this morning, you don't feel mighty. Or at least you don't feel present. God in heaven, would you help us to trust you? Help us to trust you when we can't see you. Help us to believe that you are present, even though all the evidence points in the opposite. Help us to trust you. All along you had a plan. They never would have guessed it, but all along you had a plan. For a little boy to be born in a very difficult time, grow up to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt to deliver them from evil. Then many, many years later, you did this again. You surprised us by another son being born in very strange, very intentional but shocking circumstances. Another son was born who, when he grew up, he would deliver the whole world. No one would have guessed it back then, not one of us, had we been there. But you were always in control. You were always in the driver's seat. May we learn to trust you even when we can't see you. In the name of Jesus, I pray this. Amen. Please stand with me. Friends, there are going to be some folks that will be here just at the front, right along the stage, and they would like to pray for you. You may be in one of those seasons where you cannot see him, hear him, feel him, touch him. He's gone. I guarantee you he's not. But sometimes I found in my experience that when I'm in seasons like that, I need to find someone to lean on. Because their faith may be a little stronger than mine. Their faith may be a little sturdier than mine. And their perspective may be a little different than mine. That's why we have these folks who are up here at the front. Doesn't matter what's going on. You don't have to have a major problem. It could be big. It could be little. But you just need to lean on somebody. That is what we do at Capital. We're a family and we lean on each other. So after we close the service, I really encourage you, just break away from your friends. They'll wait. They're not going to go out to eat without you. Come on to the front. Come on to the front and lean on some of these other folks. Lean on some of their faith to trust God. That He really is with you. Now, I'm going to leave everybody with a blessing. My prayer, may God strengthen your faith. May this absolutely massive God of the Exodus strengthen your faith. So that you can trust Him when you don't see Him. So that you can cling to Him when you're not sure He's there. May you learn to trust God even in the dark. Thank you for being here today. See you.